From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, President Obama revealed that we are not alone in feeling that this election season is unsettling.
The number one question I'm getting as I travel around the world or talk to world leaders right now is, what is happening in America about our politics?
And he proposed that some of the disarray could be laid at the feet of the media.
I think the electorate would be better served if we spent less time focused on the he said, she said back and forth of our politics.
That, he declared, is not the fundamental purpose of journalism.
A job well done is about more than just handing someone a microphone. But it's to probe and to question and to dig deeper.
Especially in times like these, when so much is at stake.
Because a well-informed electorate depends on you. And our democracy depends on a well-informed electorate.
Beautiful words, Mr. President, but words should not be confused with actions. Let's remember that this is a president who has been especially tough on legitimate whistleblowers and whose White House media machine routinely limits access to the press. And that this is the president who often asserts that
this is the most transparent administration in history,
while continually battening down the hatches. Representative Jason Chaffetz of Utah.
This is a pattern of stonewalling, and this administration, the Obama administration, more than 550,000 times has denied requests for Americans to get information from their government.
A recent Associated Press analysis found that this White House has set a new record for failing to meet Freedom of Information Act requests. This despite a 2009 presidential memorandum dating to Obama's first day in office, instructing all government agencies to, quote, adopt a presumption in favor of disclosure in order to renew their commitment to the principles embodied in FOIA and to usher in a new era of open government. What's more, reporter Jason Leopold of Vice has just documented that the administration has stymied the efforts of Congress to strengthen FOIA. Jason, welcome to OTM.
Great to be here. Thank you, Bob.
First, 30 seconds or less, primer on FOIA.
FOIA is the Freedom of Information Act. It's a law that is going to be a half century old this summer, and it allows anyone, anywhere in the world, to petition the U.S. federal government agencies for its documents.
And the president issued the aforementioned memo that says we are going to invigorate FOIA. But as you've reported, not so much.
No, not even close. This all looked great on paper. Obama signed this presidential memorandum. A couple of months later, Attorney General Eric Holder issued a set of guidelines instructing government agencies how to carry out that edict. And it's kind of been downhill from there, despite the fact that the administration continues to claim that it is the most transparent.
Well, the proof is in the pudding. One bit of proof is that the George W. Bush administration was far more forthcoming in FOIA requests. And then there is the White House's efforts, which you have recently written about, to stifle legislation that would reform FOIA and make it easier for the public to use.
This bill was the FOIA Oversight and Implementation Act of 2014. This was a bipartisan effort to codify into law President Obama's memorandum. This bill would have greatly improved journalists' access to government records, the public's access. Unfortunately, it was never voted upon. We heard rumblings that there was an effort by the Justice Department acting on behalf of the administration to kill it. We heard that the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Federal Trade Commission were also involved in efforts to kill this because they were worried about the fact that it would force the disclosure of certain documents that would reveal their conversations with banks and other corporate entities. But all we had were rumors. It wasn't until recently that we were able to discover, in fact, that the administration strongly opposed every effort to reform the Freedom of Information Act.
You were able to find out that the Justice Department, the SEC, and the Federal Trade Commission all were trying to stifle this legislation. By what means?
Through the Freedom of Information Act. I filed a number of Freedom of Information Act requests when the legislation died. And the Freedom of the Press Foundation actually sued the Justice Department under FOIA to pry loose this smoking gun memorandum. And then I was able to get thousands of pages of records from the SEC and the FTC that showed how they were working collectively to kill the Freedom of Information Act reform.
If you accept the notion that the president is not fundamentally anti-democratic, how do you account for his apparent hypocrisy on the issue of the transparency that he's constantly talking about?
That's a great question, and it's incredibly difficult because this is not new. You know, it was only a few months after President Obama signed this memorandum that they already started to work against being transparent. That happened in the case of a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit in which the American Civil Liberties Union was trying to get photographs of detainees and the treatment of detainees who were held in the custody of the U.S. military. The Obama administration said that they would release this, but then there was this enormous backlash, and the administration worked with Congress to actually change FOIA, to allow the Secretary of Defense to sign a waiver saying any release of photographs or anything else pertaining to the treatment of detainees would be a national security risk. So right out of the gate, they were working against their own promises of transparency.
It seems to me that there are two possibilities. The first is that the president believes, out of principle, that the government can't function properly if information from the government flows too freely. The other possibility is that he's got something to hide.
I would say that it really depends on the type of information. Much of the documents that I try to access have to do with national security. The CIA's targeted killing program, its torture program, FBI surveillance, documents that the agencies go out of their way to protect. I should say also that I filed FOIAs to find out how the government is actually handling my FOIAs. And I've seen how the FOIA requests are politicized, that it goes up to the top official to approve whether or not, you know, records can be released.
And you, of course, have FOIA'd yourself. What did you find?
This was stunning to me. Many years ago, I had filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI to gain access to documents about the brother of a high-value detainee who lived in Florida. He had signed over a privacy waiver, essentially saying that he would grant the government agencies permission to turn over anything they had on him to me. One day, I received a telephone call from his wife, and she said to me, "An FBI special agent is here. They're asking questions about your FOIA." I was outraged. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI for everything that they had on me on this particular day in which the FBI special agent was asking questions about me. A few months later, I received some documents, and sure enough, the FBI tasked a special agent to go out and interrogate my source about my Freedom of Information Act request. I've received other documents from the Department of Justice in which they sort of make fun of me and say that I'm a member of a FOIA posse. You have one attorney saying, "Oh, that should be his band name."
Well, Jason, I have one further thing to say to you.
And that is?
FOIA Posse is a pretty great band name. Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jason Leopold is an investigative reporter for Vice News.
But to be fair, though this week the president did chastise the press, that wasn't his only target.
It's worth asking ourselves what each of us, as politicians or journalists, but most of all as citizens, may have done to contribute to this atmosphere in our politics.
Nate Silver published a recent analysis that found that even when journalists attempt to cover, say, Donald Trump in an in-depth, issues-driven way, these stories simply don't gain traction. Here's Silver on the 538 podcast this week.
There has not been a single day since Trump announced his candidacy when any investigative story, so about Trump University, for example, or eminent domain, where that led the news cycle. There have been stories written about that, but never led the news cycle.
Why don't those stories get traction? Is it because we, the news-consuming public, don't truly give a rat's patoot about them? Martin Bellum, an editor for The Guardian, recently attempted to tackle that foundational question in a post this week for the website Medium titled, "The Difficulty of Getting People to Read About Lahore." He was dismayed by the fact that even though The Guardian led its website with several stories about this week's horrific bombing in Lahore, Pakistan, leaving at least 75 dead, many of them children, and hundreds injured, none of those stories were clicked on enough to make it into the site's top five most read. Bellum reflected, "It's harder to get mainstream reader empathy and interest in terrorism attacks that occur further from our shores." Of course, it's natural. But is it inevitable? Can we change it? Should we even try? Peter Singer is a moral philosopher, a professor of bioethics at Princeton University, and author of One World, The Ethics of Globalization. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We all know about this concept called homophily. We are drawn to people who are like us. And that's probably evolutionary. As you acknowledge in your book, The Expanding Circle, Ethics, Evolution, and Moral Progress, if the manner of our evolution has made our feelings for our kin and for those who have helped us stronger than our feelings for our fellow humans in general, an ethic that asks each of us to work for the good of all will be cutting against the grain of human nature.
Yes, and we just have to face up to that fact. We have to start from that. We don't have to finish there, because even if we are pushing against the grain of human nature, we are beings who are capable of thinking for ourselves, acting in ways that we judge to be better, and not just better in accordance with those evolutionary hardwired instincts, but better for others too.
But if we're talking about whether or not we read about the attack in Lahore, about which we can do nothing, do you think it's somehow morally requisite for us to actually read that article?
I do think it's morally requisite for us to read that article, because it helps to inform us about the nature of the world and some extremist organizations that are capable of carrying out an attack deliberately targeted at a playground for religious reasons.
But we already know that, don't we? Haven't we seen equal horrors on an almost daily basis? I mean, just knowing about something doesn't make it better, does it?
No, absolutely not. But we should feel some responsibility as a citizen of the most powerful nation in the world to know about the world and to have some small influence on policies which have an influence on the kind of things that happen in Pakistan as well as elsewhere in the world.
Merely reading doesn't do anything, right?
If I merely read and pass on my attitudes to nobody, then it doesn't do anything. But, you know, most of us are not hermits. We do have contact with other people. And I think that ideas spread through those contacts and those conversations. So I don't think we should see ourselves as completely powerless, even if we're not actually going to summon up the time and thought to write to our congressperson. I still think that we have an influence.
So you're talking about the tiny drip, drip, drip of awareness, like water on a stone, eventually changing the landscape so that action might be taken.
That's right. And, you know, we are talking about a society in which there are polls taken regularly. You change the attitudes of people. Some politician might say, oh, people do care about this issue more than I thought. Can the United States develop more of a focus about the world beyond its national boundaries?
I get that. But let's talk about the standard of impartiality that you've written about. You wrote in The Expanding Circle that Quote, I ought to give as much weight to the interests of people in Chad or Cambodia as I do to the interests of my family and neighbors. And this means that if people in those countries are suffering from famine and my money can help, I ought to give and go on giving until the sacrifices that I and my family are making begin to match the benefits the recipients obtain from my gifts.
Yes, I certainly did write those lines, but I did in the context of saying where would be a theoretical stopping point at which nobody could say you ought to do more. I don't expect people to go to that point, and I don't myself go to that point. But I do think that between that point and where most people are, there is a vast gap that we could go some distance towards closing.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that even your sort of reductio ad absurdum argument that you should just keep giving until your discomfort equals the person or exceeds the person that you're helping, is that rational?
You know, you might say, well, that's inconsistent with human nature, but I would not say it's irrational. I would say, in fact, if you had a purely rational being who was not biologically hardwired in the way that we are to love and care for those who we're close to, I think a purely rational being would actually try to maximize the overall good. But I accept that few people are able to take that standpoint for most of what they do.
For the rest of us workaday people, you subscribe to the drip, drip, drip theory that I proposed.
Yes, that's right. I subscribe to the idea that we are part of that pool of public opinion that influences our friends and our neighbors and others, and we ought to be informed. We ought to talk about our views with others. We ought not to push these issues under the carpet and ignore them.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure talking to you.
Peter Singer is professor of bioethics at Princeton University and a visiting professor at the University of Melbourne and author of One World, The Ethics of Globalization.
Coming up, find out what a mental patient, a seller of body parts, and a rock have in common.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The most celebrated face of investigative journalism in Africa belongs to a journalist who very few people would recognize.
My name is Anas Arimiyaw Anas. I am an undercover journalist. What you see here is me disguised as a rock.
As an accident victim. As a sheik. I am a police officer.
Over the last decade, the undercover exploits of Ghanaian journalist Anas Arimiyaw Anas have exposed human traffickers, medical malpractice, corrupt cops, and much more. Recently, he posed as a friend or relative of several defendants, offering judges bribes in exchange for shorter sentences, and then released his expose as a documentary, which packed screening venues across Ghana last year. Most of the more than 30 higher and lower court judges he showed accepting bribes now stand trial. And now, with the premiere of a documentary called Chameleon in Anas's home city of Accra, the spotlight is turning on him.
Courageous journalists like Anas, who risked his life to report the truth.
Anas is a big name in our country. But when journalists begin to play James Bond, it's troubling.
The film brings a behind-the-scenes look at some of his recent investigations. But Anas says that the film, like journalism itself, reveals less about him and more about his society.
My principle is naming, shaming, and jailing. And that's what makes my journalism different. People were tired of reading stories and nothing happening. As I kept on going undercover, the key question that I needed to answer was, what are the ingredients of prosecution? So I studied law. So when I'm undercover, I know the basic ingredients I need to get that bad guy to jail.
You probably know that critics of undercover reporting say that the technique itself is suspect because it starts with a reporter's lie.
Yes, that's fair criticisms. But I am doing journalism for my people. And what is the general purpose of going undercover? It's to serve society. And I've always told the truth that, look, I went undercover to play this role.
You're quoted in the film as saying that your kind of journalism is a product of your society. So what kind of journalism has Ghanaian society produced? What does it demand?
We have adopted curriculum based on the West. We're a British colony. So we have adopted hook, line, sinker, the syllabus from Britain, including that of journalism. And I'm saying that is fair, if only it answers the questions that are being asked in our communities.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps the Western standards you're talking about don't adequately address the needs in your society.
Exactly. The Western standards are not working because, look, whenever we try to do this kind of journalism, what we end up doing is empowering the bad guy. He goes to pay the police, he goes to pay the judges, pays everybody, and here you are in bigger trouble. The African continent has produced very good stories, some as good as your Watergate scandals. But hey, nothing happens. I say no. Look, our community is suffering. People are dying of lack of water, malnutrition, HIV/AIDS. You see, we don't have the luxury to do what other people do in the West. We don't.
In 2011, after your expose of bribery and corruption of customs and border agents, Ghana's former president, John Evans Atta Mills, stormed Ghana's biggest port and said that your film confirmed what he'd always known.
I'm aware of what they are doing, and very soon we'll descend on them. And let me also say this. Who is watching the watchman? I wish that the revelations from Anas could have come to me through the security agencies which are here. No, that has not been the case.
That proves your point, I guess. Just printing the facts won't have an effect unless you have the tape and the evidence right before people's eyes.
Exactly, because our institutions are pretty young. The police have lots of problems. The judicial service has lots of problems. Journalists have lots of problems. All I'm saying is that let us all take one step forward. Let us all move forward close to each other and realize that the ultimate beneficiary is the society.
One of your most influential investigations caused such an outcry that it led to the passage of the Mental Health Act in 2012, which now protects the human rights of people with mental disorders in Ghana. Tell me how you reported that story.
So I went undercover in a psychiatric hospital in Accra, pretending to be a patient. I had read all the symptoms. I knew what exactly to tell the doctor. So quickly I was admitted.
How did you record them?
Well, when I finally settled in, that's when my visitor came with my recorders.
How do you smuggle in a camera?
Yeah, it's easy. You put it in food. You wrap it well with a polythene. We have a food called banku. It's made of corn. You put it in the middle. They allow it in. And then when you begin to eat, you take your cameras out. That's when I put the camera in my shirt bottom. So it was pretty easy to switch on and then get the video footage.
And you found that the guards were selling drugs, heroin, cocaine, to the patients. And in order to capture this on tape, you had to buy some of these drugs yourself. And then in order to make sure you weren't exposed, you had to take some of them. And that made you so ill, you engineered your way out of the hospital for a few days?
That's correct. I don't drink, neither do I smoke. And I had all these things in my system within the very first 6-7 days. So it was a bit too much. I had to do something what they call going on parole.
Supposedly to attend a funeral?
Yes, to attend a funeral. As soon as I came out, my doctors who checked me told me that they didn't think I should go back. But hey, I had opened all the good doors within the first 7 days. And I felt that it would not be fair to leave the story hanging. So after detoxification, I went back there. And I'm glad I went back. And I'm happy that the mental health bill is passed today.
How did you disguise yourself as a rock? And why?
Well, these guys in as a rock, we have a savannah belt, and there were this camel and donkey riders who were smuggling guns.
Ah.
There was a particular hidden place that they used to pass. So what I did was to get our artist to make a rock that looked exactly like the rocky area where these people passed. And that's where I stayed, monitored them, and they were arrested, and the arms were found on them. And as we speak, they are behind cells.
Some of your exploits are really astonishing. Tell me about the spell of the albino.
The spell of albino is one of those myths that we carry around in Africa that says that when you chop the limbs or the body part of an albino, you are going to become instantly rich if it's used to form a potion for you. This has been an age-long practice. So I built a prosthetic arm and then went into Tanzania. And within the very first 2 weeks, two limbs had been chopped. One was even actually done by the father of the albino, who chopped the forefingers of the son and collected money for it. So what I did was to film the ritualist who claimed that he had seen the spirit demanding for this body part. When I was sitting with him in his shrine, he showed me samples of a child's arm that has been grinded into a potion, samples of that of adults. And then he told me that I was going to get a lot more money if I used that of the child's. So there and then, as he kept on with his incantation, I got out my prosthetic arm, and here was him very exposed, and he was frightened.
Take the albino arm. Take it. Why are you afraid?
The man.
He says what?
He says sorry.
Sorry for what? Sorry for what? Is this things that you do that kill albinos? Sorry for what?
As we speak today, he's been jailed in Tanzania.
So it isn't just corruption that you're after. It's also about destroying dangerous myths.
In fact, that is the most important, because the people so believe in these myths. If you don't shatter them with hardcore evidence, they won't move away.
You've been frustrated with what you call parachute journalists, you know, foreign journalists who fly into Ghana and do reporting that you say Ghanaian journalists could do much better.
You see, you can't fly in for a week and expect to get the entire picture. It's not fair to the continent. Sometimes, you just got to take your time to peel the onion. And when you peel the onion gradually, you are going to see the truth. I'm saying that it's nice to report on the scandals, but my colleagues should know that we are also creating new avenues to solve the problems we have. And that got exhibited mostly in this judicial scandal that I did.
This judicial scandal you talk about is the one where judges and other court officials went to trial or went to jail because you recorded them taking bribes. What is the story that you've done that you're most proud of?
One of the stories that I'm so proud of is the one you just spoke about. The reason is this. The earlier we put a searchlight on our judicial system, talk of South Africa, talk of Nigeria, the better we are as a people. When we get to deal with these systems, I am certain that more than half of Africa's problem will be solved.
Through the legal system.
Through the legal system. Because, you see, judges are the gods in the guise of men. They are our last resort, everybody's last hope. So when you find them tilting the scale of justice, it is sad. The earlier we develop the courage to confront this situation as a people, the better we are.
Thank you very much, Anas.
Thank you so much.
Anas Aromeyao. Anas is an investigative journalist based in Ghana and the subject of the documentary Chameleon, which premiered this week in Accra.
Meanwhile, in coverage of the primaries, physics is at work.
Senator Bernie Sanders has new momentum after a big weekend in the Democratic race.
Gaining momentum, a Saturday sweep for Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Bernie Sanders seeing some momentum following a decisive sweep over the weekend.
His wins last week in Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington are expected to propel him to more victories, because that's how momentum works, or at least that's what the political press tells you. But we've been here before. in the early days of March, for example.
The Sanders camp is pleased with their momentum after winning Michigan this week. That's a huge upset for Hillary Clinton.
And then, a week later,
Clinton's lead has helped put a stop to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' momentum.
The Democratic frontrunner stormed through Super Tuesday and threw a big bucket of cold water on Bernie Sanders' momentum.
Almost all, probably all, of all the momentum Bernie Sanders had.
At least Bernie's poll numbers have been steadily increasing. We've been hearing dubious momentum claims about the rest of the gang for months.
Last night, Marco Mentum ran smack into Chris Christie.
In Ohio, Trump fell to the state's popular governor, John Kasich. The win gives Kasich momentum.
Meanwhile, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush surging in a new poll. He's really picked up momentum, and Donald Trump is sinking.
The reason journalists like it is that it's something you can completely make up.
Mark Leibovich is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, a man who has made a particular specialty of identifying political and media buzzwords and beating them into smithereens.
Basically, like so much else in political dialogue, it's utter nonsense, and yet we play along because that's what we do. I mean, it was somewhat clever when, I guess, George Herbert Walker Bush used to talk about Big Mo, because I think he was adopting a sports cliche.
Hold it. Let's hear that.
What we'll have, you see, is momentum. We will have forward Big Mo on our side, as they say in athletics.
Big Mo?
I guess the only marginally clever adaptation was Joe Lieberman in his campaign for president in 2004 did a number of plays on Joe Mentum, which, you get it, it kind of rhymes, which, you know, in retrospect is probably the high point of Joe Lieberman's presidential campaign.
Is there anyone else you can think of who actually rode momentum into elective office?
I mean, I think Donald Trump, if you look at the earlier part of this campaign, was constantly citing polls. And this was at a time when, you know, politicians didn't typically do that. That was one of the many norms that he violated. I think what that did was it created a sense that he was, in fact, winning. I mean, his whole selling point was, I am winning, I will win, America will win. I mean, momentum is real in so much as success is real, and success often continues. But claiming momentum when it doesn't really exist, I don't think it has very much utility.
What language do you turn to describe reality without assigning it some sort of Newtonian property of the universe?
I think the first Newtonian property of the journalistic universe is that reporters should refrain, really from here on in, from trying to place a name in any kind of momentum construction. Look, it's very, very hard to predict a presidential race, especially this presidential race. And one of the many empty and sort of silly indicators people look to are the ephemeral things like momentum that can't ultimately be measured. Even if they're proven wrong in the next election, no one's going to remember anyway. We should try to be operating in the realm of what is quantifiable, what is real. And quite often, you know, momentum is not real. It's just a line.
Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Mark Leibovich is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. It's Newton's second law that's about momentum, how it takes a large or prolonged force to get an object up to speed, and also to bring it to a halt. We heard Leibovich say that journalists covering politics don't really do the math, but John Sides does. He's co-author with Lynn Vavrick of The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 presidential election. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, I was looking at a Nate Silver story from 538.com, and this was from 2010, and he was discussing momentum and proved, I think, that at least in primary races for the Senate, not only is there no momentum, there isn't even a trajectory. You see a lift, and it's as likely to go the other direction as it is to continue any trajectory of growth. Is he right?
Yeah, I do think that's right. The race that I probably know the best is the 2012 presidential election. And there, you saw several candidates who experienced a pattern of what we call discovery, scrutiny, and decline. So the initial discovery, where they draw attention in the news media, their poll numbers increase, that looked like momentum, at least for a period of a few weeks. But then as the scrutiny of their candidacy grew, the coverage became less favorable. Other candidates were discovered, and then they experienced a decline. For other candidates, Romney is a good example from 2012. The pattern was quite different. You don't see a rise and then a decline. Romney was kind of the tortoise to everyone else's hair. You know, he just stayed steady. No real evidence of a momentum, but it didn't really matter in the end because he became the nominee.
And yet the term persists. It's constantly used by reporters. And this gets to the desires and needs of reporters themselves.
You need to be able to talk about something that's changing. And sometimes some of the basic fundamentals of the race really don't change. You know, you can't write a story that says the poll numbers today were the same as the poll numbers were last week and the week before that and the week before that. So I feel like there is a risk at times to latch on to something and suggest that one candidate actually is gaining ground. You have to be cautious that you're not just rooting for the story a little bit to give it some oomph.
You're most familiar with the 2012 presidential race. You say that the momentum narrative really got under your skin. Tell me how and why.
There was a story in Politico that said that all of a sudden Obama's campaign was playing defense. Mitt Romney was surging, suddenly playing offense all over the map. I'm giving you quotes here from this story. And in reality, the polls were flat. Obama had lost a little bit and Romney had gained a little bit after that first debate at the beginning of October, but then nothing had changed. I actually complained a little bit to a couple of reporters about this, and one of them went all mea culpa and said, and I'll quote to you, what we call momentum is more like narrative, and we're buying into that. And what was pretty remarkable for me was that 3 days after Politico ran that story, they ran a second story that said that Romney's momentum, what they called Big Mo, had suddenly become Slow Mo. So, okay, all of a sudden we went from Romney has momentum and he's playing offense all over the map, and then 3 days later, never mind.
It's one thing to look at a blip in an ongoing campaign and look at the data and mistakenly assume that it suggests some sort of trajectory when in fact it does not. That's kind of an understandable error. What's not understandable is to invent momentum out of whole cloth for the sake of keeping a story alive. Is that malpractice?
Malpractice is such a strong term. How do I want to put this? I look at that as an incomplete job of interpretation. There are a variety of signals that a campaign is sending you. There are lots of polls. There is what you might be seeing on the ground as you travel with candidates. My objection to that particular story was that we have lots of places now that can average polls together for you and show you a trend line. And the trend line was flat. You know, the Romney campaign was somewhat famous for getting a little sucked in by the crowds and the emotion of its rallies in the closing days of the campaign. But you got to realize that, you know, just because you can go from city to city and 5,000 people show up to cheer for you, that doesn't really necessarily mean anything in a country where 100 and some million people are going to cast votes in an election.
Can you give me an example in recent history when momentum really was at play and a candidate did surge through all obstacles to victory?
The archetypal case is Jimmy Carter, 1976.
But since we've come in first now in Maine and Vermont and New Hampshire and Wisconsin and Illinois and Florida and North Carolina and Kansas and I think about 7 or 8 other states, the attention given to me and the growing enthusiasm of voters has been very encouraging.
What's interesting about the Carter story is the way in which the Democratic Party actually changed the rules. So after the 1980 election, they created these things called superdelegates, which are basically elected party leaders who have votes at the convention and whose votes are not necessarily determined by the outcomes of primaries and caucuses.
Yeah, it was the institutionalization of the smoke-filled room.
Exactly, kind of an attempt to put brakes on a candidate's momentum if it came down to it. Parties don't have smoke-filled rooms anymore, but they do things to try to make nominations battles in particular not simply a question of media attention and momentum. They try to winnow the field, put resources behind certain candidates as opposed to other candidates. It's not been particularly successful for the Republican Party in 2016.
Yeah, and I guess that leads to my final question, and that is, as long as we're going to be discussing Newton's law of motion, we should remember Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. This stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah, I think that's right. What enables a candidate to do well in a particular day or week or in a particular state oftentimes means that the opponent will see what happened, adjust their strategy accordingly, and maybe find ways to kind of blunt whatever momentum a candidate might get from that victory. And again, at the end of the day, the pattern looks a lot more complex than just, you know, one candidate steamrolling to the nomination.
John, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Bob. My pleasure.
John Sides is a professor of political science at George Washington University, a blogger for The Washington Post, and co-author with Lynn Vavreck of The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 presidential election.
Coming up, how to get famous when you're dead.
This is On the Media.
This is Brooke. When you finish listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? My colleague David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie.
This is the only idea I've ever had for a film.
Really?
I never get asked to do a film.
Really?
Never.
You know, you really should listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So please, do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Emily Dickinson, happily anonymous during her life, called fame a fickle food on a shifting plate. It's likely British singer-songwriter Nick Drake, novelist John Kennedy Toole, and Vincent van Gogh would agree. But unlike the poet, they died by their own hands, for many reasons, but partly, perhaps, because their art was relentlessly overlooked. Chantal Ackerman, the Belgian cinema auteur, killed herself last October. She was one of the most prolific and perplexing filmmakers of her generation. She made more than 40, including her masterpiece, Jean Dillman, 23 Commerce Quay, 1080 Brussels. Her last film, No Home Movie, opens with a mesmerizing four-minute shot of wind buffeting a solitary desert tree. Ackerman's uncompromising style was a major influence on the likes of Gus Van Sant, Todd Haynes, Sofia Coppola, and Michael Haneke, but you most likely never have heard of her. And she may have regretted that a little. Before her death at 65, she said, "I'd like, even if it's only once, to do good box office with a film. Once." Can Ackerman reach posthumously the mass audience she never had in life? We shall see. A multi-city North American tribute now underway aims to spotlight her work. Livia Bloom is vice president of Icarus Films, which is distributing 2015's No Home Movie, and she has organized the tribute.
How to make a noise in this cultural climate is always a challenge, especially when you're representing work that doesn't necessarily ring a lot of bells for popular audiences. Her final film, No Home Movie, for a long time didn't have distribution, even after her death. And finally, when Icarus Film signed it, it was really exciting, but it was also a really big responsibility. In this film, she's in her mother's Brussels apartment. Her mother is 86. She would die before the film had been completed. And the film shows her mother and Ackerman in these final moments of her life. The theme of family, and specifically her relationship with her mother, is central to much of Ackerman's work. Three films that focus centrally on that relationship from very different angles are News from Home, where you hear her mother's letters as though Ackerman herself might have been hearing them in her head as she looked at the streets of the city she was living in, New York.
I only ask you to write as often as possible. That's all that matters to us. Keep in touch because you are so far from us and I miss you. Daddy is so pleased when I arrive at the office and tell him there's a letter from Chantal. You can imagine. And my friends, everyone asks about you, my darling. I kiss you and think of you all the time. And so does Daddy, Sylvian, and all the family. Your loving mother.
In Jean Thielman, Ackerman switches from documentary and instead uses narrative fiction to explore her mother's circumstances by looking at a housewife also in Belgium.
And it is mesmerizing film about a Brussels widow, an ultra-methodical woman we see simply going through the routines of cooking and cleaning and bathing and so on for close to 4 hours with very, very little dialogue. The click of her heels on the apartment floor is very hypnotic in this film, and her expressionlessness has a kind of Mona Lisa inscrutability to it that keeps you just staring. But Jurassic Park, it ain't. So what I'm wondering is, as you tried to bring renewed attention on Ackerman's body of work, you face a challenge to build new audiences.
Yes, indeed. I mean, she said that while many other filmmakers are interested in entertaining, are interested in making audiences not even realize how quickly time is passing, what she wanted was to make people feel the passage of time every moment. She was interested in challenging our expectations of spectatorship about what we go to the movies for.
It is amazing what goes through your head when you're watching 4 minutes of wind rustling trees in No Home Movie. It really does get you thinking about your relationship with the film. And likewise, those long static shots in Jean Dielman. Now, Jean Dielman made Ackerman instantly a figure in feminist cinema. There barely was a feminist cinema before that. And yet, she rejected being pigeonholed as a woman director, as a lesbian director. She just wanted to be a filmmaker, full stop.
Groucho Marx memorably once said, "I refuse to join any club that would have me for a member." And I think that that's relevant when you're thinking about this aspect of Chantal Ackerman. She was unwilling to be defined by those labels, despite proudly being all of those things. That said, those communities that you mentioned, they loved her. They supported her. They showed her work. They were her base, you might say.
This must create something of a conundrum for you, because on the one hand, you want to honor her wishes to be better known, right? On the other hand, if I were you and I were a marketer of Chantal Ackerman's films, I would absolutely try to cultivate the Jewish cinema audience, the lesbian cinema audience, the feminist cinema audience, the avant-garde cinema audience, target all of them in order to build a larger critical mass. But would you dishonor her way of going about things if you take the logical marketing path?
No, I don't think so. I mean, her work certainly during her lifetime showed in all of those settings and more. And she greatly appreciated the support of her base, even if she wanted to be acknowledged within the larger context.
Just in New York, you're at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, BAM, and you have a tribute at the Film Forum, Anthology Film Archives, the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens, and other cities in North America. Similar things are going on. In finding venues for her work, did anyone say to you, "Oh, yeah, right, Chantal who?" You mean the woman with the four-hour movies with no dialogue?
That phrase, "Chantal who," is probably the phrase that I want to hear the most, because it means that her name and her legacy is reaching new viewers and new audiences. And when they ask that there'll be answers from critics on Chantal who, and most of all, that the work itself will be available and can speak for itself.
In the introduction, I made a comparison to Nick Drake of Pink Moon fame and Vincent van Gogh as having found their fame only after death, in fact, after suicide. Do you have any hope of achieving anything for Chantal Ackerman that these other artists achieve from the next world?
to my mind, maybe if Van Gogh or Nick Drake had been a gay Jewish woman, it would have been more apt in terms of what Ackerman was up against.
Livia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Livia Bloom is vice president of Icarus Films, and it is she who's organizing the tribute to the late Belgian filmmaker Chantal Ackerman. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Mythili Rao. About Mythili, she has been working with us through the WNYC Fellows Program, and this week we have to say goodbye because her terms ended, but also because her baby is due like any second now. Thanks, Mythili, and good luck with everything. We had more help from Dasha Lizitsina and David Conrad, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Casey Means and Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.